From the farms of Kansas to the rescues in Ontario, Canada, where Deb Thrift went from bird breeder to bird rescuer, to the bayous of Louisiana, where 9/11 Ferret Alert rescued over 300 parrots after a hurricane, KC Bird Whisperer International Productions hosts Bird Talk Live Online on Bird Talk Radio, live from Kansas City. Your business may benefit from our large listening audience by visiting birdtalkradio.com/advertise. Find out how to put your business audio commercial in front of millions of listeners. Please enjoy this pre-recorded live show segment from our studio in Kansas City. I am your host, Mike Kiger. Thank you for tuning in to Bird Talk Live Online today.
Different kind of thing. It's not like you would think. I do have some birds, though, that I have had come to me that were, when they are arriving, they'll give me the bird and they say, this bird hates women. Just hates women. I'm like, okay, good to know. Good to know.
I'm and laughing because I've seen a lot of this in my grooming.
Yeah.
I used to do a lot of bird grooming and even did some mobile grooming service. And I'm laughing because I've heard this so many times and all these stories.
Sure.
And, you know, my bird hates men, or my bird hates women. He bites my husband, or he bites my wife.
Yep. And it's really more about the bird and the people that they, because we have to remember, these guys are wild animals anyway. They're not domesticated like a dog or a cat. So they're wild and their instinct is very high. The motivation is high. They choose who they like. They just do. And it may not be a male Senegal choosing, or a male parrot choosing a female human. They might choose a male human and say, I really kind of like this guy. And then that doesn't mean they like all males either.
Mm-hmm.
Male humans, I mean. So they're very specific. Parrots pick up on things. Their intelligence is very high, and they decide who they like and who they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where I was going with that.
What about hand raising? Even Senegals, would you think a person would be more successful with a younger bird if they actually want a Senegal? From my experience, hand feeding birds raises the bird up to be more tame, and they usually grow up, liking everybody, and even though they might bond with someone, they're still friendly with others.
So, no. In the beginning, all birds are like that. All hand-raised birds are like that. All baby birds are loving and wonderful and, cuddly and, all of the things that we all know about what a baby bird looks like when it's hand-reared, not parent-reared. And, what will happen to a Senegal parrot, we have found, and this is something my avian vet helped me understand too, is that when they get to be about the age of two, they go through a stage called terrible twos, we call it, because we just need to name it something. So we just give it a label, terrible twos. So what's that mean? Well, in the wild, going back to the tree thing and thinking about how they live, at about the age of two is about the time adolescents are at the point of getting kicked out of their family group, especially the males, too. And they have to go find their own tree. Well, at 2 years old, they know it's coming, too, and they're starting to feel more independent, and they're starting to do more things and pushing the envelope in certain ways and things like that. That's still going to happen to that baby parrot that you had as a loving, cuddly little snuggle bug. All of a sudden, when he turns two, things start to change and people go, oh my gosh, what happened to my baby, my bird? He bites me now, and he bites my husband, or now he likes this person and he never liked him before. And, their behavior changes drastically. And this is typical of a Senegal parrot. Again, it's the non-flock mentality. It's the hardwiredness of not being in a big group. So the best thing you can do is train that baby when he's young by over-socializing him, which is very key, and I'm glad you brought that up as a point, too, because take that baby everywhere. everywhere, have everybody touch him, everybody play with him, everybody do everything with him so that he can continue to have that when he gets to that stage and you can still pass him off. But also training, especially from the year between 1 and 2. I'm a high believer that in the first year of a bird's life, you should just be a bird. And what I mean by that is don't go into this whole thing about formal training necessarily to do tricks. Let them be a bird. You can still train them to do things, don't get me wrong.
Buddy Waski would love hearing you say that.
I think it's just so crucial.
And Tony Silva, right. Both of them have said the same thing, that we need to let these pet birds learn more about being a bird. Help them be a bird than a pet.
And I so totally believe that, especially after seeing all of the damage that can be done just by virtue of being a rescue and seeing what the leftovers have done, what has happened over the years. I really think that if birds were left to be a bird, especially during the very first year when it's crucial in their development stages, it's the best thing you can do for that bird. It's the absolute very best thing you can do for them. They're learning to be independent. They're learning to be able to satisfy themselves, do things on their own. You're not coddling to them. There's just so much value in that. During the second year, from year 1 to year 2, get them to do things with using communication skills, like I had mentioned before, with the food motivation and learning about hands and, you know, things like that, to the point where they understand there's a communication. Now we have a dialogue we can have. Now when I want you to do something, you'll know. If I give you this nut, you can go stand on the station if you want to give it a formal name. People talk about stationing animals. Okay, here, give you your nut, Victor. Go sit on your perch over there and eat it, and I'll clean out your cage. That's stationing at its simplest, purest form. Mm-hmm. And it works, and it's easy. And the bird understands it. He's like, okay, cool. You're not going to touch me, and I can eat my nut over here totally comfortable from you. Change the papers and get out of here so I can be my bird. I'm going to be a bird. You know, I'm going to do my thing. I'm going to play with my toy and, you know, those kinds of things. The other thing that I think that people do is, and it's unfortunate, and I was a person who'd made lots of mistakes to find these things out, so I never want to come across as a know-it-all, this is exactly what you should do, because I learned too. But I think a lot of the mistakes we make is to try to force a bird to do things we think they should be doing. In other words, if I go up to a cage and I say, hey, would you like to come out, and the bird's not wanting to come out, don't make him come out. Leave him be. And a lot of times people think they have to have that bird come out of the cage. Oh my God, he's got to come out of that cage. No, he doesn't.
Right, because they don't eat like dogs. Like a dog, you could throw a treat to a dog a billion times a day, and he's probably going to eat it. Well, they're usually, they're larger animals. They have a larger stomach. And I was just thinking, too, that that it's a matter of perspective in it, where a bird is a smaller animal with a smaller stomach. And it's something you and I talked about earlier when I first had Maximus here, my blue and gold. I was chopping up big bowls of fruit and veggies and hey buddy, here you go, half a pound of fruit and vegetables, and he's eating two or three pieces and leaving the rest. And eventually I thought, oh, right, he's smaller, and he's not going to have the appetite of a dog or a cat. Right. Of course, we don't usually train our cats, but I was kind of following you there on the, baiting them with food. A bird is, they eat like a bird, so they're not always going to want that treat, right?
Right, and that's such an important thing. A lot of people train their birds at the wrong time of day, and here's what I mean by that. They'll feed their birds, and then they'll go eat breakfast themselves maybe, and then they'll come back and they'll go, okay, it's time to get trained, Tweety. And, Tweety's full for the max. He doesn't care what you're, even if it's his favorite food, he may even not, kind of look at you. It's like me going out for a steak dinner and having a cupcake afterwards, and then somebody else goes, oh, you really like that cupcake. I'm going to give you another one. And you're like, man, I'm telling you, I don't care what you give me. I'm not eating it. And that's the same thing we have to think about in perspective. If you feed them a full meal and then you expect them to train afterward using their favorite motivating treat, it's probably not going to happen.
Right.
So when you train your bird is essential. What I do here is I take my bird's food and water away every night. And people go, oh, my God, how can you think about it? In the wild, is there a bird sitting up there with their food and water bowl all night long? No.
Exactly. They have to go find it. The morning.
First thing
and they're not drinking all night long while they're sitting up in the tree. Right.
Yeah, you get it. And people usually get it when you explain it that way. It's like they don't need, and this is something, again, my avian vet. Now, of course, the caveat to everything I say like this is avian vet, and I can't stress that enough because certain birds have certain needs. Some birds, there are diabetic birds, there are certain birds that need their water. There are certain birds that are going to need that food all night long. But that's a minority, not the majority. So what I do is I remove the food and water every night. And that's it. It's gone. In the morning, I'm the one that brings you the food and water. Aren't you glad to see me then? Yes, you are.
Another positive training issue. And we were listening, audience, what she's reminding me about in this part of this dialogue is that everything you do is training, right? Whether it's positive or negative, every action trains the bird some way.
Yes. And so thereby taking the food and water away at night, they're real happy to see me in the morning because they know I'm bringing food and water. And it's a real easy thing to do. Plus, I'm also getting rid of bacteria in that event, too. I mean, if we leave the water bowls in overnight, they're going to build bacteria overnight because the bird's not down there stirring that water bowl, you know, breaking up anything in there. There's usually food particles in the bowl. You don't want to leave that in there overnight. And why leave a food bowl in there? Just so that the first thing in the morning you uncover the bird or you wake the bird up, where do they go? To the food and water. No. You be the one that brings the food and water. You be the one. Give them breakfast in the morning.
And Maximus doesn't eat first thing in the morning. He just kind of eases into the day and he'll come out of his condo and climb up there and sit there and stretch his wings for a while, you know, and then he's kind of like, okay, I'm ready for Starbucks later, you know, he doesn't eat right away.
And neither do we. We don't jump out of bed and the first thing we do is grab our,
slam down a big omelet or something.
So, you know, we have to put things in perspective of and think about it from the bird's point of view, too. If your food and water is there all the time, 24/7, there is no motivation for me, you know, to bring it to them and have them be happy. You know, switching out the food and water bowl on them. A lot of times I hear this, that birds are real possessive of their food and water bowl, and they get real nasty around that when you're trying to change it. You know, take the food and water bowl out. They try
to
go to the
food
door.
My conure does that. Yeah, when I take, I use water bottles myself. My birds drink out of water bottles, and I have a lot of reasons for that I'm not going to get into because I'm more interested in what you do and why you do these things, how you work with your birds. So I'm not going to get into all my, you know, habits and listening audience, if you're new to keeping birds, it's different from bird to bird and situation to situation. Some people use big water bowls and some people use water bottles, and there's different reasons for that. But Mike Conyer, when you said that, I just was remembering my pineapple conyer. If I take the water bowl out, whether it has any water in it or not, he starts screaming because he bathes in it. He takes a bath in it.
Yeah.
I have a water bottle that he drinks out of, but he loves to bathe. And I tell you, if there's water in that bowl, he'll bathe all day long, several times a day. He just loves it. And like you were saying, I think my habit, you know, of taking the bowl out, putting some cool water in there, putting it back in. Okay, Sam, bath time. Every time I come and take it out, he starts yelling, you know, screeching, because he knows it's bath time and he's excited. So I've trained him to do that in a way by doing that, but he loves it. And he, that's one, I guess, example of dealing with a water bowl.
Absolutely. So I just like to do it that way, and the birds all know what's happening. So at night, I mean, my African gray I have one personal pet, and it's an African gray, and he talks like crazy. He picks up on everything. At night, when it's time for me to pull the water bowl, when he gets tired, he starts saying, time to go night-night, time to take your water, time to take your water, because he knows that's what we do.
So that's my next bird.
Because
of the talking,
and
I love the whistling. The whistling sound they do, I just love it. It's the coolest. They whistle so cool. It's the coolest sound.
They do a lot of stuff that's fun, but they also, you know, there's a caveat to every bird, and that is, you know, be careful. You never know what you're getting into, because he can also do, you know, the fire alarm, and he can do, you know, there's all the other stuff too. And his decibel level is way up there. But, you know, he knows
imitating
that night.
The phone ringing and have you running through your phone all day long. And
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they have something like a 900-plus word phrase vocabulary potential listening audience. If you're new to this, we're just talking about African gray. And I'm looking for my next bird is going to be an African gray. And because of their ability to talk, and I want to teach, you know, a bird to say some cool things. Max won't talk, so I'm hoping I can teach an African gray to talk, and maybe Max will start talking because he's jealous, something like that. I don't know.
You never know.
Max says about two words, and not very often. You know, so.
Well, one thing I do want to tell you, tell the listening audience too, and you as well. I've had African grays come and go from here as well. When I first started, I had not as many Senegals and wasn't so species-specific, and I had a lot of them at the same time, grays. But I'll tell you what, there have been a couple come through here that never have said a word. So you can't, it's not guaranteed that if you get an African gray, it's going to talk.
Right. So I'm going to get one that's already talking, then I know. Yes, and you know, that's a case with a lot of parrots. My studies, listening audience, I'm trying to think about everything I've read and studied in 30 years, but to me, it seems like probably more than half of the birds are not going to talk. So if you want a talker, it might be best to get one that's already talking, then you know. You might have a chance at getting them to say something you want them to say.
Right. Yeah, and that's something just to, you know, throw out there, because I know a lot of people want African grays because of the talking ability that they have, but not all of them will. So, you know, it's just like any other bird. Senegals talk too. I have some really awesome talkers here that do really well with verbalization and communication skills with talking, but I have a lot of others that never say a word, and some of them are the best behaved birds. So, you know, you just never know. I mean, you can't count on that being something that you can get as a species saying, I'm going to get an African gray because they talk, because they may not. That's just one of my things.
Right. What about flying? We were talking earlier about flying. You said you teach your birds to fly, and you like for your birds to have the ability to fly. Why is that? And what's your position on wing trimming, if you do any wing trimming at all?
Okay, so I have a lot to say on that, actually, because there's a lot of good stuff that I've learned recently, too. So let me talk about specific to the rescues here. All the birds here are fully flighted, fully feathered, so they're fully capable of flight, unless they have some kind of an issue that's physical. I have some here that pluck, that will do that probably for the rest of their lives, have seem in that way, and that's the way they are, and they'll never fly. Some who have had damaged wings, and on and on. But those who are capable, who have maybe been clipped their whole life, and I have some that have come in their 20s, never knew how to fly, but were clipped. I allow them to grow their wings out, and I teach them to fly, and there's a couple reasons why. One is health. It is healthier for a bird to be able to use his lungs and his air sacs the way that they were intended to be used, and the only way they can be used really well is through flight. The other reason that I do it is because I want them to be safe with their flight and understand how to land and understand how to maneuver. And here's a good example. So I have a 20-year-old bird who comes in here. He didn't know how to fly because he was clipped his whole life. Maybe he never fledged properly because years ago they didn't do that. Now I think there's a changing trend out there, and there's more people, more breeders, who are allowing their birds to fledge at least before they're clipped the first time. But
what do you mean by fledging? I know what it means, some people listening may not understand. Buddy Waske says that a lot, too, and I know what it means, but it may be a term that a lot of people kind of new to bird keeping won't understand.
Okay, so fledging is when a baby bird is given the opportunity to learn to fly for the very first time. So in the wild, that's how they do it. They kick them out of the nest, or they just, mom leaves and they have to follow. So they're going to flap their wings and they're going to try to fly, and they will learn. And that process can take a couple of days. In the wild, you'll see baby fledglings is what they're called, because they're learning to fly. They just fledged the nest. They just left the nest. And so they'll be on the ground for a few days trying to figure it out. And they will figure it out. They'll get the strength. We like to, now the trend is getting there, where people are starting to believe that fledging is the right thing to do. Let's let these birds fledge, really fly, understand how to fly before we take the flight away from them. It's good for them to understand how to use their wings so that later in life, if their wings do grow out or they change ownership and the new owner wants them to fly, their wings grow out, they know how to use it. They know how to land. They know how to not fly straight into the wall, or into the window, or into, the ceiling fan, or whatever the case may be. Ceiling fans are a whole other issue. That was a bad example. You shouldn't have ceiling fans on, in my opinion, if your bird is out regardless. But what we do here, I teach a bird that has never fledged to fly, even if he's in his 20s, by using a very simple method, and this will go back to the training issue I had mentioned with motivation. So they will learn to hop from one perch to another. That hop then becomes a little wider gap because I'll move the perches farther apart. I'll move the perches far enough apart so that they have to hop and then flap a wing to get to the other one. So they're going back and forth for treats. Eventually that gap widens more and more to the point where they're flying from one place to another. I give that a name as well, so I'll tell them what they're doing. Go to perch. I learned this from Michael Stazin. It's very important that you give things names. And Michael Stazin is known as the parrot wizard, and I learned a lot of this stuff from him. But I'll tell you what, it's key to give it a name, too, and say go to perch or perch or whatever. Because then when the bird's out flying around, I can say, go to perch, and he knows what I'm talking about. And he goes and lands on the perch. And if I have these perches around in my room, and a bird gets spooked later on after he's learned to fly, after I've taught a 20-some-year-old bird to fly, he's going to look for a perch to land on. Because now he remembers, oh, my gosh, all I have to do is go to perch. Yes, go to perch. You're fine.
A place of safety, right.
Yes, go to perch. Go to your perch. Just perch there. You're fine. So I have perches all over the place. And when a bird gets spooked, because it happens everywhere, thunderbolts or whatever. That bird gets spooked and he starts flying around the room. They're skilled enough flyers at that point that they're not going to be bouncing off the wall. And they're going to look for a place to land because now they know how to land too. So teaching a bird to fly, in my opinion, affords them the ability to fly, to be a bird, to breathe properly, to have the exercise that they need, and to have the skill that they need to do it properly without being in an environment that's unsafe. Of course, you're going to make your environment safe. How do I mean that? You're going to have a ceiling fan turned off. You're going to have your doors and windows shut when your bird is out, and you're going to have places that they can land that are safe for them to land. That's all it takes. It's really easy. But you do have to be thoughtful about it. You have to put some thought into it. You have to make sure that it's a safe place, and you have to teach them. That's what we do here, every bird here. Yep.
I wanted
all my birds learn. Yeah, they've all learned.
No, go ahead.
All I was going to say is they've all learned. So they've all learned that there's a safety point. You know, I can land here. It's okay.
Okay. And listening audience, if you just joined us, I'm with Ginger of Ginger's Parrot Rescue, a 501c3 organization, nonprofit, bird rescue in Casa Grande, Arizona. And you can go to our podcast later. Actually, I think it's going to happen tomorrow because it's late tonight, and I probably won't get this uploaded tonight. But you can go to our podcast later and listen to this entire conversation and benefit from all this great information with Ginger, who's been teaching us about a lot of behavior training. Of course, she's really good at rescuing birds, and they have a really great organization there, a great facility. But what I've noticed and what really attracted me and got me really interested in having Ginger on Bird Talk Live Online is that I think, in a nutshell, so to speak, this is what I would say is a full service bird rescue. Not saying others aren't, but this one definitely is. And they're taking birds in and preparing them to be adopted, socializing, behavior training. But this particular rescue is oriented to Senegals, cockatiels, and smaller birds. The training is the same for all birds that we're learning about with Ginger right now. And Ginger is a staff member with Oasis Sanctuary in Arizona, a Humane Society of Arizona partner. Also, an AFA certified aviculturist. It's American Federation of Aviculture. She's completed levels 1 and 2 of AFA certification in aviculture. 2012 graduate of Susan Friedman Behavior Works Program. So she's really done her homework. She's spent a lot of time practicing her education with birds and behavior training. And if you go back and listen to the show on the podcast, you're going to see that she has a lot of great solutions for all kinds of behavior problems. And it seems to be, it boils down to positive reinforcement training. Am I right, Ginger? Am I on the right track there?
Absolutely. Yes, and there's one thing that you just reminded me about regarding that. What I stumbled on and now have since taught people to do for years, and it's just one of these things where you do out of necessity. I had, in the beginning, I did not have my birds flighted. I had birds that came to me clipped. And so clipped birds, when we think about clipped birds, we think about a bird on a play stand all day, pretty much all day, you know, on your week, on your days off, right? You take your bird out, you put him on your play stand, and he just hangs out. I had some birds that came to me, and they would climb down from the play stand, and they would run across the floor and try to attack each other. And I couldn't figure out what to do to pick them up because they would, you know, get all bitey with me. So this would be like in the very first year that I was doing this. And I had this big rope swing, huge rope swing. And for those of you that don't know what those look like, they look like a big round rope fixed swing. And I had that sitting on the table, and I grabbed it and thought, well, I'm going to see if he'll step up on this, because then I can't get bit. And the bird did. He stepped up on it. And I went, wow, I think I'm onto something here. I used rope rings of every size and shape you can think of in this rescue. I have them all over the place. And every single bird that I have that comes here learns to step up on a rope ring for transport from place to place. I don't get bit that way. The birds don't become frustrated because they understand it's a transport vehicle if I need them to be transported. And it just worked out beautifully. And it's a positive thing. And the way I made it a positive reinforcement is this. When I first got onto it there, that was necessity. I was like, I had to pick this bird up here, step up on this rope ring, I put him back up on his perch. But after that, I realized I can take a bird, allow him to step up on that, give him the treat like we talked about earlier, by saying, you step up on, here's what I would do. He steps on the rope ring, because I would hold the rope ring in one hand. I would have his treat in the other. The bird stepped up on that rope ring. I'd say, good, and give him that. Good, and give him the treat.
So and the word good is like the clicker. You replace the clicker with
the
word good.
Bridge. Mm-hmm. That's telling that bird, you did what I wanted. That's good. Now I'm going to give you this for that. This is your reward. But it has to be immediate and it has to be fast. So, after I learned that, I was like, okay, now I can't always use the rope ring or perch or whatever you want to call it to be a negative thing. In other words, every time I want the bird to go back in its cage, I'm going to just use the rope ring. No. That's a piece of purpose. So what you do is you use it for all kinds of stuff. So I would use it to transport them to and from one room to another, to and from the playstand, to and from the cage to the carrier, all different kinds of places like that. And it was all of a sudden an experience that was unexpected. They knew the outcome was always going to be different. It wasn't going to be something they could expect.
An interesting, challenging, motivating experience. We talked about that earlier, too, that we need to make the training interesting so the bird is motivated and challenged.
Right. It has to be fun for them, because they are so intelligent that we need to think about it as they need to know they can trust us. So they know that they can trust the rope ring. Like, I'll never take a bird on a rope ring and then groom him, for example, because that's like, they hate grooming. So why would I do that? That's just totally going to be. Right. So that's a piece of purpose.
Yeah,
or
like
I'm not going to do
towel
something
into the room.
Exactly.
Right.
So I don't do things like that, but I use it that it has a positive outcome. The positive outcome is always going to be on the other end of that. Wherever we're going, you're going to get a reward, and that reward is going to be a treat. And eventually we can take that out of the equation. After a lot of repetitions and a lot of time, they don't expect a treat every single time they go there. They may get a head scratch, and say, good bird, hang out here for me. Let's sit down and work on the computer. Let's do dishes. The thing could be different every time. The reward is spending time with the person at the very end. It doesn't always have to be a pine nut or something. So, but you have to eventually get there. And to get there is training. And the way you do training is with food motivation. So it all kind of comes back down to that. But that's the key, in my opinion, is to have it be fun, motivational, have it be intelligent, and something that's going to be a positive reinforcement and not a negative. What's great about this, using my rope ring, I've had other birds that are unflighted who have crawled under something, like under another cage, and I don't want to stick my hand under there and get bit. I'm not going to do that. Why would, but that's normally what you wouldn't have to do. I'm not going to poke a stick under there, but the rope ring, they all know. So I'll just put the rope ring down on the floor underneath that cage and say, come on, let's go. And they get on it and they're like, oh yeah, that's right. The rope ring's here. Where are we going? So
it's like the
positive city
bus. Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. They're like, hey, this is my stop. All right, let's go.
That's cool.
It's become a real positive thing to use. And like I said, I have many of those around the place. Every room has several of them. And I just, you know, they're always available. If I have another bird that lands on another bird's cage, I grab a rope ring and just go get them. I don't have to say, get out there, no, get out, yell at them or anything. It's nothing. It's like it's a no big deal. I just walk over with the rope ring.
They understand the purpose of it.
Yeah, it's so easy. To take a bird that's aggressive, I've had a lot of people tell me, my bird will bite me every time I put him in the cage. It's like, okay, first of all, it's because he doesn't want to go in the cage. We all know that. So make going back into the cage something that's acceptable that he wants. Give him a highly valued treat that you never give him any other time. So I have some birds that when I want them to go back in the cage, I know they don't ever want to go back. They could be out all day long. One killer, his name is Sammy. He could be out forever, and it doesn't matter. He's going to want to bite you every time you put him back. So he just gets transported on the rope perch, because that's the vibe you get, and he gets a treat. He gets a Nutriberry. Win-win. He's thrilled to go back in his cage because he's getting a Nutriberry, which he never gets any other time, ever. And I'm happy because I'm not getting bit. So it works. And
is there's that, no is that Texas freeze-dried Nutriberry?
Yeah, Prissy Puffs.
Prissy Puffs. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yep, we were talking about Suzanne Ort earlier, and listening audience, we had Suzanne Ort on the show recently, and it turns out Ginger uses some of their chop food products, and they're great. And, you know, even for people to eat, I think Suzanne said that some of her customers say that they even sprinkle some of that on their own salad.
They do. They do. Her food is off human grade. It's awesome stuff. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And it's so good. When you open her bag of chops, you know, it's freeze-dried, which is totally different than dehydrated anyway. And so you open that bag and it's like freshness. You can just, you want to make a salad out of it immediately. It's so good. And the birds here love it. And you can either rehydrate it with water, even though it's freeze-dried, it just means that they, you know, it's not, it's different than freeze-drying is done with heat. I'm sorry, freeze-drying is not done with heat. Dehydrating is. So it's not losing any of the nutrients. So when you open that bag up of something freeze-dried, it is awesome. And it smells good. And she sells a lot of products for humans, too. So she has all kinds of freeze-dried
goods. Yes, she is.
On her website.
Yes, we're cross-promoting here. But yeah, she's coming out with some bee products. I saw on her page she's got her beehive going, and they're going to come out with some bee products, too.
Which is going to be a great addition to what she already does.
Yeah.
So, my understanding is the
dehydrating, especially with fruit, changes an okay sugar to a bad sugar, sucrose to fructose, or fructose to sucrose. And so dehydration is not the best. And I guess freeze drying just, you know, it just freezes everything in the same structure, and it doesn't change anything.
It's really a difference, I'm telling you. And the food looks fresh, you know. So you open it up, and something that's green when it was freeze dried is still green.
Yes, so, and Suzanne says it has a shelf life of something like 25 years.
25 years, isn't that amazing? So a lot of people buy things
And for all these people that are going to bug out when the world ends, you know.
Right. For the shelters that people have their own, you know, shelters.
Phenomenal. Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing. So,
your bird's getting fresh stuff that's
exactly
the same as it was when it was freeze-dried, pretty much. And
right. And so for me here, because of the amount of birds I have, and because I currently I'm in transition. I'm in an in-between spot where we just broke ground today for our brand new facility. And once that is built, we'll be able to get back into having volunteers. Currently, I'm in a transitional state, and I have no volunteers. So right now, my time is really tight. So for me, I don't have time to do the chop, the freeze, you know, to do the chop, to go out, buy the vegetables, bring them home, prepare them, chop them, and feed. I don't have the time.
Mm-hmm.
Suzanne is perfect for me products like that are perfect because it's ready to go for me. I just take the package right off the shelf. I rip it open. I rehydrate it if I want to. Typically what I'll do is I'll mix it in with warm water because birds like warm things to get them to eat their veggies.